Welcome to this podcast series on inclusion and education from the University of Leeds. Our research brings together experts in education, childhood and youth studies with an aim to promote equality across family, education, policy, legal and community settings. To read more about our work, please visit the School of Education website. You can find this link and others discussed during the podcast in the programme description.
Hello, my name's Luke, and welcome to the IC podcast from the University of Leeds. Today we have two guests, if you'd like to introduce yourselves.
Okay, my name's Yinka Olushoga. I'm a lecturer in the School of Education at the University of Sheffield, and I co-direct the BA in Education, Culture and Childhood there. I'm also the director of the British Academy Research Project, Childhoods and Play, the Iona and Peter Opie Archive. My research interests are in children's play, past and present, in intergenerational play, storytelling and creativity.
Thanks. I'm John Potter. I'm Professor of Media and Education at the UCL Institute of Education. And before that, I had an existence as a primary school teacher. So my research is mainly with primary school children. I'm interested in new literacies, media education, media in education, and in recent years, particularly the implications for that of play in different circumstances. So I've been involved in two or three play projects, which I guess we'll get to that in the conversation. But that's what I'm interested in, new media, digital media, literacy and education.
Could you please give me a brief overview of your current joint project, highlighting its aims and objectives?
But this project is the third in a run of projects that we've done together with the Sheffield School of Education. For this third project, we responded to a call by the UKRI to explore the impact of COVID-19 on a particular area of life. And when we scanned the projects that were being created in response to that call, we noticed that there was a gap, really, in particular, there was nothing really about children's play. And we thought that children's play, with all of us having such an interest in it, and particularly its connection to archives, we thought that it was wrong that children's play should be neglected in respect of their well-being, resilience and recovery from the various impacts of lockdown, the loss of amenity, the loss of social contact with each other. But we were also looking for ways to explore more than just loss, but also children's creativity in response to these circumstances, and how they played anyway, and how their play was changed, and how they responded in that way. And so our part of the project down in London was really to have the overview, and we'll be doing some ethnographic case studies. But I'll hand over to Yinka to explain more about what they were doing for the Sheffield element of that.
So Sheffield, I think because of our involvement with the OP Archive, we were very aware that there was a historical perspective to be surveyed and noted during the pandemic in relation to children's play. So our instincts were that we needed to record children's play now from their perspective as they experienced the pandemic, and that that's different to asking for children's memories of it when they're older or grown up. I think also as historian, experiencing a pandemic has been incredibly interesting, because as a historian, you know, you study different aspects of health and, you know, pandemics and plagues in earlier times, and experiencing it as a process, it's not an event, is it? It's something that we're in the middle of. We don't know what the end date is. And again, wanting to think about that in relation to children's play, and to realise that as we move in and out of lockdowns, that they're going to have different types of experiences. And so from the work of the OPs, we got an appreciation of the importance of everyday play, and that inspiration to survey it, to look at how play has stayed the same, how it's changed, and how the pandemic might be allowing children and adults to spend more uninterrupted time together and experience something different.
When you were doing your research, you collaborated with what in the paper was referred to as child researchers to conduct interviews, engage tours around the playground, and you even had like GoPros on their chest to record them playing together. Did any of this sort of data that you gathered surprise you or tell you something different than what typical like adult researchers would have done by like observing children or asking questions themselves?
I think it definitely did. This was the ethnographic work, which was done by Julia Bishop and Jackie Marsh in Sheffield and the parallel school playgrounds in London with Kate, myself and Kate Cowan, where we were in two London playgrounds for a long time, you know, every week through for 6 months and doing all of this work. So this was the previous project, Playing the Archive. And what we found out about children's play, in particular, the ways in which media was incorporated, underlined some of the findings of the earlier project that Rebecca Willett and Chris Richards had found in their playground research, which was that media forms part of a language, part of a repertoire, and part of a set of resources for meaning making. So it doesn't threaten physical play. Sometimes it's positioned as either or. Either they're being digital and they're ignoring other people and they're focused only on the screen, or they're running around climbing trees. The children work with an assemblage of material and they play in hybrid ways and fascinating ways. So all of those ideas of getting children to tell us about it were to circumvent that situation where a researcher sits or stands next to a child with a microphone and says, tell me about X, Y, and Z. So children would talk to each other, and they really enjoyed going into role as researchers in that project. We had voice recorders and we'd hand them out at playtime and they'd run around with these voice recorders and come back, and it would have captured lots of really fascinating data. So in terms of what it told us, it told us that there was still many traditional games, that the traditional rhyming and clapping and skipping games were inflected with media, not just quotations, but where media had become part of the play, and the media references were not just simple references, but they were part of a cultural remix that was going on with the resources to hand. And we found that there were all sorts of darker elements of play still present. One of the places that we worked in was the school that I used to teach in many, many years ago. And the same ghost was there, for example. The Green Lady was still there. So we were able to talk about that. And we actually ended up making a couple of radio programs about this, which we will hopefully also be doing in this project. But to answer your question, yes, child researchers and talking to each other about the things that they do was an incredibly important part of it, which means it's actually much more difficult to sort of replicate that approach in the present project. Because, of course, our conversations online with children are mediated with adults, and there are adults present. I mean, it isn't that we don't try various methods, and we can come onto that a little bit later on.
Including the school examples that you've explained, has it kind of changed the type of games that they're playing? Or even reflecting on your past questions, are there, for instance, in certain games, references to COVID? For instance, reading your research, people were building COVID hospitals in Minecraft. And would you speak on that, please?
We will, but perhaps if I start, Inka, and then if I miss anything, I'm bound to miss it, because it's such a rich, you know, there's so much to say about this, really. It's the nub of what we're doing. And so what we've noticed is that, first of all, some things have remained very, very similar. Some things have moved online. There has been a lot more sibling play. So we've seen some kind of nice, where you know, I have to play with my brother. I have to play with my sister. There's nobody else here, you know, that I can actually play with. So there's kind of been this family grouping that people have played on Zoom. They've played Zoom games with relatives and with friends, gone on Zoom hide and seek in the house and all of those sorts of things. And it's similar that adults have done lots of quizzes or did in the beginning of the first lockdown. They found ways to use that kind of camera-based technology. But also there's, as you've pointed out, there's Roblox and Minecraft in creator mode. We found a lot of, not so much in the gaming mode, but in the kind of building things. There's been lots of joint building projects. We've seen lots of evidence of construction. We've seen lots of evidence of outdoor play, because when people get out, they really want to make use whenever they can, whenever the weather allows, of their local parks and of even the minimal amount of meeting up that they've been allowed to do at different times. And in terms of schools, well, It's a rich and varied tapestry. This is what, you know, what Yinka was just saying. We want to get in there and see what's been happening with the spaces. But anecdotally on schools, we have seen or heard examples of children adapting the touch games, like, you know, the various games of tag or tig or he or it, whichever part of the country you're in, whichever word you use for that chasing game, have been turned into a kind of shadow version where you touch the shadow. Or we were hearing from a group of children the other day about how they had their coat and they kept their coat at some distance, and if they touched the coat, then they were it. There's various examples of things in bubbles, aren't there, where people have adapted the various space games in playgrounds and have made bubbles. We've also, anecdotally from slightly older children, I heard from my son is also a teacher, both my children are teachers, one in secondary, one in primary. And he said there'd been some interesting impacts on friendship groups when key worker children were in with each other. And the key workers would be quite stratified, I guess, between children of doctors and people who are looking after people in that way, and also the children of cleaners and people who are looking after people in that way as well, two kinds of ends of the spectrum, and that they were forming friendship groups that they didn't normally form. So that we keep coming across these sort of weird benefits to the situation, which is a strange thing to point out, but that there are some constructive things like sibling play and children being made to play with people they wouldn't normally play with.
Yeah, well, I suppose reflecting on what's happened in families, again, thinking about the different phases that we've had, you know, lockdown one, most schools were trying to, you know, get to grips with the online teaching environment, and that didn't happen straight away because, you know, they were doing an awful lot to begin with, supporting children of key workers. And so I think in lockdown one, a lot of children found that they were experiencing time in a different way. I think, you know, I think adults felt like that too, quite a lot of us. But if you think about, you know, a normal school day and children being, you know, taken through different lessons and periods, you don't really do anything for very long before you moved on to the next thing. And I think in lockdown, children had an opportunity to slow down and to wallow in their experiences and to you know, spend an entire day on something, perhaps spend several days on something. And I know my own children, my son in particular, got involved in lots of projects that came from his own experience, his own interests, but he absolutely adored the fact that he could do that and have the time to explore it. And I think also the idea of getting to know your area as well. A lot of children in usual normal life, you're at home and then you're taken to school and then you're taken to an after school club and then you're taken to judo or karate, and then at the weekends you're going to do all these activities. And of course that was completely interrupted, and instead you saw families exploring their local environment, lots more walking. And I think that's really interesting, because if you're walking through an environment that is already a very different experience, we know lots of research tells us it's actually really good for us mentally as well as physically to be experiencing walking in an environment.
Do you think, like, in the way that you've been saying this, would you say that, like, lockdown has really kind of brought people, not so much as like a community together, but they've got to know more about their communities?
From my experience, I would say yes. I know several people who have found walks that they didn't know exist, canals they never had walked alongside, and that they will share that. I mean, social media has been really important, I think, throughout the pandemic, and we've seen that. And that's something as a historian I often think about, because, you know, to experience the pandemic with that opportunity to still stay connected and to talk about your experiences instantly with people you know and people you don't know. Unique to this pandemic, there have been pandemics in history, but people did not have this ability to connect with each other.
I think that's right. And I think that there are parallels with adult experience as well. I mean, I know that people I speak to have got to know the area around here, where I live in southeast London, a lot more. There's been a kind of fascination with, you know, I've taken loads and loads of photos of my own area, which I would never normally do. I'd be perhaps travelling, or either on holiday or academic travelling or something. but walking around here and focusing in on the detail of life in this area. It is a parallel, you know, experience that adults have had, including when I mentioned quizzes and things like that and that kind of play that adults have also been doing. So there's a little parallel sort of development with that and staying in touch with each other on Zoom or whatever platform they're using.
If you reflect on children's play from a historical perspective, what might we expect to see when COVID-19 ends? Will play become more cautious, or do you think it will quickly return to normality, as some people might put it?
That's a really interesting question, and it's something that I've been pondering recently. I was out a day out with my children a few weeks ago, and we went to the Yorkshire Sculpture Park. And at one point, as I was getting them to, we were going to go inside a building, so we were putting masks on, and it suddenly struck me that my children are the same age as my grandparents would have been in the 1918 flu epidemic. And so this kind of everyday thing we have of getting your mask on, etc., that would have actually been something that my grandparents would have seen, would have experienced. And it's something that was never spoken of. I have no idea what their experience was. And that fascinates me. And it does make me question, if you Google or you know, look up pandemics, often the other word that's associated with them is forgotten. And I think that's really interesting that we tend to have this tendency to forget things that have been difficult or unpleasant, or that just don't feel relevant anymore as we kind of move through life. And, you know, that can be very positive. But actually, I think, you know, as a historian, obviously, I think there's something that we're losing if we don't remember. And I think, obviously, this question, still, again, we have to go back to the idea that children are having different experiences of the pandemic. And I think also maybe we need to separate out the impact of anxiety about COVID and the impact of these different ways of experiencing home, school, family, neighbourhood, that for some children may have been very positive and even empowering. They've learnt new skills, they've had time to develop those skills and have those experiences, and some where children will not have had as positive an experience. I think that children, as I say, play is constant. So throughout the pandemic, they have been playing. We know that research across the world where children have been in difficult circumstances, in difficult and dangerous places, play still happens in those places. And that children, as they come out of those experiences, continue to play. And that play sometimes might be an escape from that. And sometimes it might be a way of actually returning to it and processing it. So I think actually we'll probably see different children doing different things. And again, depending on their age, because it's, you know, it strikes me that there are children who are experiencing the pandemic now who cannot remember pre-pandemic. So when we talk about the new normal and the return to normality, this is their normal. And so how we supporting them as they turn into our normality will be their new normal, if that makes sense. So I think, yeah, there's not an easy answer to this. And I do think maybe some children will be more cautious. They may be more reluctant to do things, and others might be absolutely desperate to embrace this normal, whatever that turns out to be.
Yeah, I was just going to say, no, I completely agree with all of that. And it's so interesting, especially the point that you just made there, Inka, about people not knowing any different. And I think, anecdotally again, on the first morning after schools reopened, I have got friends who are primary school teachers, and they said what was really amazing was the kind of at playtime, the sound of it, the sound of children reconnecting was unbelievable. So for those children that had played and did know what play looked like and could remember it, so we're talking sort of 5, 6, 7, 8, 9, that kind of age group, they just flooded towards each other. And there was a frenzy of clapping games and skipping games and what are we going to do next, and really fast, rapid re-establishing of those social connections. But of course, what we will see, I'm sure, I'm convinced of, is a continuing inflection of that play with the historical events of the pandemic. it's just a hunch that we all have, isn't it, that when we're looking, sifting through the data, that we're going to find games have changed and references to the pandemic. This is a line of inquiry in our ethnographic interviews as well, which is, you know, what do you think has happened to the pandemic in terms of play? Is the language of the pandemic coming into the language of play? So we're working on finding all of that out as well.
Looking at the archives of Peter and Iona Opie, is there a fundamental difference in the way the post-war generation played compared to this current digital generation? Is play becoming more of what you might call a single-player experience?
Well, when we look at the Opie archive, we can see that for some of the post-war generation, there were differences. Again, play continued, everyday play continued, but where and how some children played, there were differences. At the moment, we've been looking at a collection of essays from the London Borough of Camberwell, where there was an essay writing competition held regularly. And there's a really interesting collection of essays from 1955. Obviously, London was covered in bomb sites from the Blitz, and these provided very exciting, risky play locations for many children. So we can see that for some children, these are the ultimate playgrounds. There's loose parts, play resources to be found aplenty. There are huge affordances for risky but creative play. And in their essays, this comes out vividly. That's really exciting, the best place to be. Other children, however, in different parts of the borough, view them with absolute horror in their essays as these dirty, frightening places to be avoided at all costs. So again, you know, I think there's not a one single experience, but children were very much aware of these different places and had different responses to it. Might be reflecting their own preferences, or it might be actually reflecting some of the adult dialogue and discourse that they heard about, you know, where to play and who to play with. I think the other thing that comes out in the OP archive is that post-war children, like children today, absolutely embraced what was new in popular culture. And this is absolutely reflected in their play. So play, you know, rhymes and, you know, songs, they develop and they incorporate television shows and characters. One set of essays that we've been looking at recently, talking about the 1950s craze for American horror comics that were very popular amongst children, but very unpopular amongst adults, and eventually were actually banned. And the children are writing about them, and they're loving the frisson of excitement at these scary tales and the lurid colours that are in these comics, and it's striking how similar these discourses are to discourses about digital play. So today, you know, we, as John has already said, we see children incorporating television, animation, sorry, in particular. My children are obsessed with anime, YouTube, TikTok. So lots of digital content is being absolutely absorbed, drawn upon and elaborated on in children's play. And so we see that digital play is more complex, and it's very much interlinked with offline play. It's not a different thing. It's the same stories and themes that are happening across these different formats. And I think the idea about the single player experience, first of all, I think, you know, children in history have played single games. They've played marbles by themselves. They've played solitaire. And so children do play digital games by themselves. And for some children, particularly non-neurotypical children, that can be incredibly important. So I don't think we should in any way see it as a problem. But our experience is that actually children, again, move seamlessly from playing something by themselves to then playing it with someone else, to sharing it in a different medium, as John's already talked about. We've seen that in lots of different apps and games and platforms that children are experimenting with.
I think it's true to say, isn't it, Yinka, that the Opies were also dealing with that narrative. Yeah. You know, they were speaking back to the narrative of children won't play anymore because they'll go to the cinema or listen to popular music, so they won't want to play with each other anymore. And, you know, every single study that we've ever done has shown that to be absolutely not the case. Children still want to play, as Yinka said, they play on their own, yes, but they still want to play with each other, and they will reference popular culture and media tropes and make new things from the resource of popular culture, which is so fascinating and interesting. So we have to underline that with every project we do, that it still goes on.
I think the jokes, I think that's what I really love about. Yeah. And I think, you know, we've seen this with older children. So I think teenagers can be forgotten in the pandemic. And, you know, for them, I think probably lockdown's been harder than if you're a six-year-old. Staying at home with your mum and dad isn't as overwhelming as the idea of doing that when you're a 13-year-old. But the way that this remixing and hybridising of popular culture and making quite cheeky, sometimes irreverent commentary that, you know, about the pandemic and about life in general that older children have been doing is something that's very creative. And I think humour has been important in the pandemic for children as well as for adults.
Going forward, how can your field of research be expanded on, and what future projects might be on the horizon?
Future projects depends on funding, and research funding is not easy to come by, but we will be looking into how to keep things going in terms of observing children's play. But we've got a couple of different strands of this, really. One is to make sure that we have more diversity in the play that we're uncovering. We want the archives that we're creating to represent the world as it is now. And so we want to be more neurodiversity, but more ethnic diversity and other forms of diversity we want to see reflected in what we collect. And the other thing that we're very interested in doing is looking across countries where the particular experiences of the pandemic have been broadly similar, but in some cases not quite that similar. So we want to know what have children been doing in other countries. And with that in mind, we have many colleagues in international networks who are interested in working with us. And, you know, we already have some agreement to share data with Monash in Melbourne in an intergenerational play project that they're doing. So these are things that we're all exploring. We don't have any proposals in at the moment, but we would like to expand this and internationalize it and diversify it.
And another strand that we've been looking at is that obviously we have the OP archive in this country, but other countries also have their own archives of children's experiences of play. In particular, we got quite excited about an archive in Finland, didn't we, that has children's drawings from the post-World War II period. So a chance to connect with some of those archival collections and to, again, make those comparisons would be really interesting.
Yeah. I do think that that's what makes the project unique, is that connection to the archival experience and the kind of notion of curation and how you record experience and then how you look back on it. And children have been very interested in a question that we will ask them about: how do you want to represent this to somebody in 20 years' time who, you know, has never heard of the pandemic or doesn't know what went on, assuming that we are free of pandemics in 20 years' time? I certainly hope so. But you know what I mean? It's that idea of how do you interest children now in what they might want to tell or record, or how do you get them to think about what they might want to record for future generations? So that we think there's a lot of work to be done yet in this area.
Well, John, Yinka, thank you very much for coming on the podcast, and thank you very much. Goodbye.
Thank you for listening. For more information about our work, please visit the School of Education website. If you have any questions about our research, or if you would like to study with us at the University of Leeds, you can contact the Research Centre Director, Professor Michaelis Kontopodis, for further details. You will find all relevant links and contact details in the programme description.